There's a lot that young people in 2023 worry about, and surveys show that 46% of girls in America have reported that their body image causes them to worry often or all the time. And that is compared to 25% of boys across the nation. But you're still talking about a quarter of young boys who are worried about the way they look. They're insecure about their bodies or about just themselves. And so this morning we have family therapist and child development expert Dr. Erica Bochnick here to give us a little insight on how we can help our children develop better positive body image and self-concept within themselves. Hello, Dr. Bochnick. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me today.
I'm so glad to have you here. First of all, why has this become such a growing issue in America, or has it always been a problem among youth, the idea that your body is just not what it should be? It's not good enough.
I know for many parents, it feels like this is a new problem or an escalating problem. And in some ways, it is. The children's mental health crisis overall has been skyrocketing for more than a decade. However, there are some things that are actually quite boring and old about this problem.
What do you mean by that? And I'm wondering if you're referring to the fact that we've been comparing ourselves to supermodels, for example, for generations.
Yeah, you know, and even longer than that, there's always been in societies this idea of an ideal beauty type. I mean, we see evidence of that from centuries ago, even in various societies across the world. It is a way that dominant groups tend to sort of hold people in line, so to speak. It's always been used as a control tactic, especially for women, that there's sort of an ideal, beautiful way to look. And if you don't look that way, you're somehow less than.
Dr. Bochnick, I'm wondering, because most people who are educated or just logical thinkers know that when you're on social media, for example, there's a good chance someone's using a filter. It's not what their real skin looks like, or it's not the thinness that their face claims to be, or even the color of their eyes or freckles on their face can be authentic. And we know there have been several, my gosh, dozens of reports where supermodels have come out and have said, that's not what I look like. They have altered my photos to make it look like somebody that I am not. So with all the facts that we have, why is it it's so easy for us to still believe what we're seeing? We still want to look like something that doesn't even exist.
It's such a great question. And I do want to say that you're really right on around risk factors. We do know, increasingly, we really know for sure, research is showing that social media is a very big part of why the children's mental health crisis is growing at such an alarming rate. But to answer your question directly about why we still see these ideas as beautiful, even though we are aware that they are merely artistic expressions and not real people, really has a lot to do with the way that we tend to center physical beauty in our own self-concept.
So we're talking to Dr. Erica Bochnick about this. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into child development and specifically this topic we're talking about today.
Oh, thanks so much for asking. You know, my whole life, I really wanted to be an advocate for children. And I thought about that in different ways, teaching, law. And I decided on family therapy. But once I had gotten the family therapy degree, I said to myself, I really want to be an asset to parents. And so I didn't stop there. I got a doctorate in child development. I had two postdoctoral fellowships in child psychiatry and infant mental health. And then I did, you know, a couple of decades of research on parenting and emotional development in families. And I feel really proud to be here now in a position to really help families with the latest science and good advice they can use.
I'm curious, Dr. Bochnick, besides social media, because we know that's a huge culprit in the problem at hand, is the idea of your body is not what society wants, is that also generational? And I ask that because I know I come from, unfortunately, a long line of people in my family who have very bad self-esteem. They do not think they're thin enough, pretty enough, talented enough, worthy. I have a lot of people in my family who do not think they're worthy, and it's daunting. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized, wow, I'm very much at risk of carrying these things, because I can remember even growing up thinking, oh, yeah, I was always chubby. I was always chubby. I always thought to myself I was chubby. And when I look back at my photos now as a, you know, as a mom, and I'm talking to even my child about these concepts, I'm looking at my pictures and I'm like, wait, why did I think this? Like, I was a peanut. I was teeny. I was so small. And yet in my mind, if I didn't go back and look at them with a healthy mindset, this is what I always thought of myself. And I'm wondering if generational thoughts about this also play a role in why people think that they are not what you should look like.
Yeah, and thank you so much for sharing that. I know a lot of your listeners are probably thinking, me too. That's exactly me. Moms come in to see me all the time and say, the household I was raised in, there was not, you know, body positivity in our conversations. I want that for my household. It's really a common feeling. And it is the family relationships that actually make the biggest impact on children's self-concept. And parents don't realize just how important they are. Around the early school grades, they notice that children are responding to cueing in the environment outside the family. But the fact that they're responding to it doesn't actually mean the influence of it is greater than what's happening at home. But the big mistake parents make is to try to shut down the conversation completely around bodies and food and exercise. There's a tendency to want to sugarcoat it or sort of say, don't look behind the curtain. We believe, you know, food is energy. And the problem with that is that kids are really primed for learning in childhood, and they're paying attention least to what you say, and they're paying attention most to your actions, your affect, your repeated behaviors over time. And what they need most is for you not to ignore the realities that they're facing, but be in it with them. Talk openly about these struggles and be kind of a thought partner, but also view them as a thought partner and how they're navigating things.
We're talking about body image issues and how kids perceive themselves looking, and just a lack of self-love. And how do we make that problem go away? How do we combat the issue that kids are facing, even adults? And we'll get into that in a second. Dr. Erica Bochneck is here this morning, a family therapist and child development expert, to talk about this. So let's start with how we can create a safe and loving environment so that kids can express themselves freely. They can talk about, you know, maybe their insecurities and make good choices when it comes to taking care of their bodies and loving their bodies as well.
So there's really about, I would say, three things I want to highlight that parents should do. One, and this is the most important one, research shows that a child's self-concept, and an adult as well, a positive self-concept inherently, necessarily includes an assessment of physical beauty. You just can't run from that. It is part of how we think about ourselves, for better or for worse. So what we really have to be able to do is boost positive language at home about physicality. Don't run from it. Don't be afraid to say, you look so beautiful today. Your hair is looking awesome. I love how in this family we have these round hips. I think they're so beautiful. You have to give your child your standards, essentially, of beauty, so that they have flexible thinking that multiple standards exist, that the things that they're seeing in the outside world that look so homogenous, well, that's just really one way to think about beautiful people. So you need to really up your convo about that at home. The second thing is that you have to be aware that while physical beauty is part of self-concept, it's not the whole of self-concept. So you also have to think about a balanced way to talk about yourself at home, things you love, things you're proud of, the ways that you sort of understand your own personhood, and then also offer that conversational space to your child to be able to highlight You know, because what we really want is not to pretend there's not going to be days when your child looks in the mirror and doesn't like what they see. Mm-hmm. But we hope on those days your child might say, you know, my hair is not doing what I want to do today. I'm going to put it in a ponytail and I'm going to be my best self because it just doesn't matter that much. It doesn't matter that much, right? And then the next thing that I really would like to see parents do more of, and this is a little bit of a bonus, right? Like those first two things, really zeroing in on a balanced conversation about self-concept is the most important. But to the extent that you can, you have it in you as you heal, as you grow, find pockets where you can be truly joyful about food, exercise, body, getting dressed. You know, I'm a mom of young kids. I get it. There's so many days that I'm in sweats and I've got my hair in a bun. And, you know, again, the point is kind of versatility and flexibility. But I also have days where I get dressed in clothes I love that feel good on my body. And I say that out loud to my kids, that it's fun to feel pretty.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though, Dr. Bochneck, how do we create that kind of an environment if we, the adults, struggle with our own body image?
It's such an important question, and I always say, start at your beginning. And so, again, the mistake a lot of parents make is kind of a fake it till you make it attitude, right? Like saying things out loud that they don't really endorse in their hearts. And again, children are listening the least to what you say. They know it's the most fallible form of communication. So you really can't start in an aspirational place. You have to start at your beginning. And if your beginning is, honestly, I have many days where I just don't feel like I'm in the right body. I have many days where I look at this one part of my body and mm-hmm. I'm like, ugh, I wish it was different. It's okay to say those things out loud. You just have to give your child the full conversation. Here's what I do on those days. Here's how I think about it. Here's some reasons I think I feel that way. And even though I know in my head and my heart that those other voices shouldn't matter, I'm human. They matter. I feel them. Do you ever feel that kind of pressure? Imagine the gift you're giving your child when you say, look, I'm not perfect. And on your days when you feel like you're having thoughts that you can't share with anyone, you can always share them with me.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's as simple as just trying to let them know that they're not in this world, you know, fighting those battles solo, that even as an adult, it's something that you're still working through or that you had to work through as well, being relatable and not so dictative. Yeah.
What you just said is such important wisdom, because when parents, well-meaning, try to create a culture in their home that is so disconnected from the reality, like, we only care what we think. We don't, those supermodels are fake. We don't care. Effectively, you're not changing the narrative for your child. You're just leaving them alone to navigate the outside world.
Yeah, that can be really dangerous. I am curious, we're talking to Dr. Erica Bochneck. Are there trigger words that we as parents should avoid? For example, I have a 4.5-year-old boy, and as I mentioned, statistics will show girls definitely struggle with this more, but my son actually has become very sensitive, I think, at times to the word heavy. So when I pick him up and I'm like, you're so heavy. You're getting so big. Oh my gosh, you're getting so big. You're so heavy. I need to, you know, whatever. I have seen that he sometimes will then, you know, if he goes to my mom's house, for example, he'll say, no, don't pick me up. I'm too heavy. I'm way too heavy. And my mom, you know, works out with a trainer. I mean, my mom's in ridiculous shape. She does not look like she's 63. She looks like she's 45. So she's like, don't be ridiculous. But it's not coming from a place where he's protecting her. You could tell it's coming from a place of, I'm too heavy for you to hold me. And so I didn't know, like, are there trigger words that parents should avoid? And if so, what do you replace them with? What do you suggest?
I really wouldn't worry about saying the wrong thing, if I'm being honest, because I think there's more damage done by trying so hard to say the right thing and effectively not being real and authentic in the relationship, because that's what kids most need. But we have to adapt to our own children. If your child has hooked onto a word like that and seems to be thinking about it, Have the conversation. What does that mean to you? When I say the word heavy, what I mean is I'm so proud of how you're growing, but it sounds like maybe you're concerned about it or you think about it differently. Now, it may be that your four-year-old is able to respond to that. It may be that your four-year-old is like, I don't know, and changes the conversation. But you've put it out there. You've mm-hmm. said, let's talk about how you're feeling, how you're reacting. It might be another child reacts positively to that word. The point really is just to be able to connect and talk about these things. The one word choice I really recommend staying away from are euphemisms for words that as adults we're afraid of. And, you know, again, because there's an axiom in family therapy that you can't not communicate. Everything you do, every way you are communicates something. And so staying away from words with funny euphemisms communicates to children that we should be afraid of those words.
Do you have like an example, only because I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying?
I know a lot of families have replaced the word calorie with energy.
Oh, and I see. Okay.
It's really inauthentic, right? Because you're still talking about calories. That is what you mean, right? Like, I hear moms sometimes, and dads too, parents saying sometimes, like, what, you know, there are no good or bad foods. White foods give us quick energy. Green foods give us longer lasting energy.
I see what you're saying.
So that's abstract. It's an abstract concept for children. And so in some ways, they don't necessarily even need that information. But the reason you're doing it is because you're trying to say, don't look over here. Don't call it a calorie. That's actually the meaning of doing that, right? It isn't the here and now for them. They don't understand necessarily that connection.
That's really interesting. Dr. Bochneck, I feel like we just scratched the surface. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime because I think these concepts are great, especially as we head into the summer season and we know people in bathing suits, wearing less clothing, body image becomes a bigger issue, I'd say, this time of the year. I'd love to have you back on really soon.
Absolutely. Let's do that.
That would be great. And I thank you so much for your time this morning. Dr. Erica Bochneck here on WICC. I'm excited to introduce you to Food for Friends. It's been around for just about a year and a half right here in Connecticut. And a bunch of middle school students put this together. And we're going to learn all about it right now. We actually have Ryan Murray here, who's going to be mostly the spokesperson. Ryan, good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
And then we also have in studio, let me put your mics on so we can say hello. We've got Sony here as well as Marlo and Jillian. Good morning.
Hi. Hi.
Good morning.
Very exciting to have you all in studio. So, Ryan, tell us, if you don't mind, Food for Friends, what is it?
So we are a nonprofit that works to take our passions for cooking and baking and use them as a way to give back. So we'll do bake sales, we'll donate food, and it's really just a way for us to use our passions to help our community.
Why did you come up with this idea? Was it you who came up with it? Was this a collective group idea?
It was mainly me. I grew up in a family. My sister was a Girl Scout, so I always saw her doing things like bake sales, and I always wanted to do it. And then I met Zoni when she moved to our town, and we started baking a lot. And so we thought, if we're going to always be baking, we might as well be doing it and putting it to a good cause. And so then it was born, and then we had more members join, and Jill and Marlo came along, and then that was Food for Friends.
So, Zoni, tell us why you got involved with this. What did this mean to you? Why were you drawn to this?
Okay, so, like, from the time I've been growing up, I was always, like, cooking with Mom in the kitchen and everything. And I'd even, like, when we had, like, parties with friends and everything, I'd make, like random little foods. Like, I made these like cinnamon and honey covered grapes that no one really liked, but you know, I was just trying to, you know, pitch in.
I think sound interesting. I would try them.
Yeah, they're okay, I guess.
You're like, yeah, don't. Okay, yeah. Go on. All right, so but you like to experiment with that kind of
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, and like my grandma would always cook with me and everything. And so then when I moved, like the first time Ryan and I hung out, we had like a baking competition. And so we always just like baked together. And then kind of like Ryan gave, like, told me the idea, and I was like, wow, that's like a really good idea. And then, you know, made it happen.
I think that's really neat. And then, of course, I can't forget Marlo and Jillian. You guys both joined in with this as well. Kind of a similar story. Were you both into baking or just, you know, enjoyed being around your friends? What got you guys involved?
Yeah, so I actually, before I joined Food for Friends, I wasn't, like, really into baking.
Oh, interesting.
So I was more into the idea of, like, the nonprofit kind of, like, helping the community. And but as I, like, started baking, I realized that I actually really liked it, especially when I was baking with all of my friends. And I think it's especially really rewarding to know that you are baking for such a good cause, you know? So I think that's what really drew me in.
Yeah. And Jill?
Like, same thing what Marlo said. I was friends with Zoni, and I started baking with her and Ryan in the summer. And I started really liking cooking and baking with them. And then Ryan came up with the idea of starting this charity. And I was really on board because I really like helping the community. And I just, like, you know, like, yeah, just like that.
Yeah, it feels really good. And so, Ryan, tell us, what is Food for Friends? Like, who are you benefiting and what are you making for people?
So we try to both benefit people by donating food and donating funds from food. So normally we'll have bake sales and certain things, and we try to pick local causes in need. So we have done dog shelters before, we've done our food bank, we've done our senior center, and really whoever is in need, we try to look around and see who is in need of funding or who is in need of food around certain times of the year. And so we'll usually do a bake sale, and then we'll overbake so that we have extra food at the end. So then we get to donate both that food to the food bank or to whoever needs it, and then we also get to take those funds and donate as well.
Okay, so don't get mad at me, but you guys are in eighth grade. I don't think I was allowed to, like, even go near an oven until I, you know, was responsible enough to drive a car, I'm pretty sure. Do you guys just go to one of your houses and bake together? Like, how often are you doing this? What's happening? Bring me into the kitchen. Show me what you guys are doing. What's happening? Whoever wants to take that. Zoni, it seems like you want to tell me.
Yeah. All right. So usually, like, we'll do research. We try to do it kind of frequently so that, like, you know, we stay active. And we'll just find something that, like, could use help, like, an organization or something. And then if it's, like, seasonal, we'll do something. Like, we've done, like, a Christmas bake sale and done, Christmas treats, like cookies. And then, we'll just get together at someone's house and we'll start baking. And, I like to say, like, it doesn't feel like a chore. Like, it's fun.
Right.
Like, it's rewarding and it feels good to do it.
How much stuff are you making? So, like, let's take that Christmas bake sale, for example. How much were you cranking out? And are we talking, like, different variety? Is it just cookies? Is it a bunch of different things?
We normally do a different variety of things. We try to do something that, like, if you're dairy-free or if you're vegan or gluten-free, you can have. But then we also try to give people a sort of variety in case you don't like something else. And so we usually bake quite a lot, which is why we usually have leftovers to give to the food bank. But it's fun.
That's amazing. All right, Food for Friends, which is really, I just think it's amazing. Come on, if you're being honest, what were you doing in eighth grade? Because I could tell you I was not baking. I was dancing, though, I will say. I was on a competitive dance team, so I wasn't getting into trouble, ladies and gent. I was not doing that. But I wasn't baking with my friends and benefiting the community in eighth grade. I can tell you that. And what I find really impressive about the work that you were doing is that it was right in the middle of the pandemic. So about a year and a half ago, this is what, maybe 6 months, not even, after you guys went back to school in person, and you decide to start benefiting the community. And I think that's just something that's worth noting, because a lot of, you know, students across the country really have struggled after the pandemic. So how did you instead take what was a very isolating, troubling time for a lot of kids and turn it into an opportunity to do good and give back?
So I feel like after the pandemic, there was such, like, a lack of community, as everyone had just been isolated for 2 years straight, pretty much. So for us to be able to sort of bring that community back was really important, as we were, like, starting at and as we were continuing, because I feel like there was such a lack and people were just so disconnected, and our community as a whole was very disconnected, and there were so all of these causes that had been sort of put to the side during COVID that now they were in even more need, and so it was very special for us to sort of get to give back and also help those people.
All right, I'm going to ask you something, and you could totally ballpark it. Any of you can weigh in on this. How much do you think you have baked in a year and a half? How much? Or how much money? Or how, give us an idea of how much you guys are baking.
We've raised just about $1,000, and then we've probably baked...
Oh, God.
Like, a lot. Yeah, we've baked... We've done pie fundraisers where over... We've done two pie fundraisers where combined we baked 20 pies.
My God.
And then wow. Each of our bake sale probably has about like 200 or 150 items.
What? So. And it's just the four of you, right? Like you guys, that's your crew. That's it. This, I'm looking at the full team right here. Yep. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. So, and what's funny is Zoni, by the way, everybody who's listening, Zoni's mom and I work together. This is how I found out about them. So I wanted to know from Kim how much of a mess the kitchens end up being, because you guys rotate houses. Kim, you've gotten out okay, it sounds like, but some of you have had some times in their kitchens at home. Jill, it sounds like you have a story of how big of a mess it has gotten on some of your baking extravaganzas, if you will.
Yeah, so this was around like this time last year, sometime in like February, and we were doing a bake sale, and the day, like, I kept on messing up or something like that, and it came to a part where the oven was on, one part of the oven was on, and I have like two ovens in my kitchen, so I was thinking, you know what, I'm gonna start the bottom oven, because why not? So then I start the bottom oven, and I open the door somehow wrong, and the door hinge comes off, and then I'm like scared because it's not going back on, and then my mom comes out and she starts yelling at me, and I'm like really scared because the oven's on, and she turns off the oven, and so then I'm like scared, and so my mom has to put the door like on it, but it's still not like fixed, so then she had to call somebody to fix the door for like $100, but I was like really scared because I thought it was gonna be really big trouble because I like broke the like door hinge, but we had to like get a new like door. But the guy came and just put it back on. I must have like pulled it up and then pulled it down because it came right off the hinge and came off.
Maybe. Either that or you became the Incredible Hulk that day.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it was your superhuman strength.
Right? Yeah. Something happened there. But do you see now why I wasn't allowed to function in oven until I was 16 years old? I mean, that just speaks to the truth there. That's hysterical, though. I'm glad that everything ended up okay. It's amazing. And by the way, all four of the young people I have right now in studio are all in middle school. They are part of the Region 15 school district, and they're eighth graders. I just think it's amazing what you guys are doing. So I know that I would imagine you guys have more on your plate coming. What are you going to do now, especially transitioning into high school? High school's great, but I will tell you it's busy. It's really, really busy. So how do you plan to continue with Food for Friends? And if so, how often will you guys work on this?
So we do plan to continue. Hopefully we'll be able to do something monthly or something every 2 months. But I think the great thing about going into high school is there's a lot more opportunities for us.
True.
So with all of this new knowledge and all of this new experience we have, we can have bigger fundraisers and we can really expand to impact more of our community and raise more funds.
And the extra classes we can take, like cooking classes, that could always benefit us. And, we also utilize, like, our breaks, like summer break, spring break, everything. We use those a lot, too.
Absolutely.
That's a really good point. Will you expand the group? Will you guys let more people come into your crew? Or is this, it's a done deal? We're like the mighty four.
I think it depends on how much our fundraisers are expanding. Mm. Because if we're getting more fundraisers and we're baking more and we're raising more, then definitely. But I think at this point right now, with just, like, what we're doing right now, having, like, a few fundraisers, doing some smaller things, I think a group of four is pretty good because, you know, we can balance everyone's schedules and we all get along really well. But if we expand, then definitely.
Okay, and none of you can move away. Can't do that. Can't be moving away because then we got a real problem and we're not ready to replace anybody. So don't be doing that. Everybody stay friends. Mm-hmm. No drama, none of that. We got to stay keeping. But seriously, I think the four of you are very impressive, and I think you are serving such an inspiration to young people, especially those who are struggling. Do you feel that baking also fills sort of, I don't know. I kind of want to ask, like, if it feels maybe what kids typically are going through in middle school, does it fulfill maybe feeling like some of those things that, yeah, especially the ladies, I'd love to know from you, if you feel that this group and the work that you're doing and being involved with community and doing an activity that is wholesome and pure and it's just beautiful, really, how has that helped you in middle school compared to maybe young girls especially who are not?
I think baking is kind of just a form of therapy in a way, especially since we all know that we're helping someone baking. So I think, yeah, just doing it with friends and making time to bake is just a really special, like, time and moment, because when you do bake with all of your friends, then, like, you forget about everything else and you're like in the moment. And yeah, I think it's really special.
It is. It is really special. And well said, Marlo. I love that. So it is Food for Friends. Anybody who's interested, you can go onto their Instagram page. It is Food for Friends, spelled out. Food for Friends 21 is the number. Food for Friends 21. You can message them if you want to learn more, if you want to get involved with them. They are in the midst of building a website, it sounds like, Ryan. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're in the midst of that. And, of course, if you want to reach out to them as well, you can email them. It is foodforfriends, the number 21, at gmail.com. Foodforfriends21 at gmail.com. And I want to make sure I give all the full names. So, Ryan Murray, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We have Zoni Hamisfar, who's here. So
thank
glad
you.
You're here, as well as Marlo Gabriel.
Thank you.
And Jill O'Connor.
Thanks.
And don't rip off any more doors, Jill, okay? We understand. We get it. We get that you are like a bodybuilder, but we don't need to be breaking the kitchen, okay? We don't need to do that. No, you guys are fantastic. Thank you for coming in off from school. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I hope to hear about you guys very soon. You can always come back in studio whenever you want, okay?
Thank you so much for having us.
But, like, don't skip school for it, because then I get in trouble. It's a whole HR thing, and I'm not ready for that. But come back whenever you want. Again, Food for Friends right here on WICC.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Kelly. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. Thank you.
I'm glad to have you here, Senator Kelly. I know healthcare spending is a real concern for Connecticut residents. Can you, first of all, just tell us what the current discussions look like up in Hartford when it comes to this issue?
Well, I think, you know, the discussions, what we're trying to focus on and bring the discussion to is that, you know, 12 years ago, the Affordable Care Act was passed and made certain promises to families across Connecticut that health care would become affordable, that the quality would improve, and access to that quality and affordable health care would be enhanced. And unfortunately, if you talk to people, as I have gone over the past 12 years, knocking doors at election time, you find out that Connecticut families are frustrated because the cost of healthcare continues to increase and, you know, access and quality is starting to take a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing that came out, and we saw this from the Connecticut Hospital Association and various hospitals across Connecticut, was the Kaiser report that demonstrated that Medicaid and Medicare doesn't pay its full share. It pays a discount rate somewhere between 60 to 75 cents on the dollar of care. And that coupled with the COVID relief funds that they received that are now being reclaimed by Medicare, our hospitals are really, not doing well. They're losing money in many instances because more people, you know, somewhere between 70-80% of people who receive care in hospitals are on Medicaid and Medicare, which are your single-payer system. That's the government-paid health programs. It's not insurance, but mm-hmm. it's paid for by the government. And in Connecticut, we have the fourth lowest Medicaid reimbursement rate in the nation. And, you know, we have one of the highest and most expensive healthcare delivery systems, but our government doesn't pay for it. And when the government doesn't pay for it, quality and access suffers. So we know this. We know it's too expensive. We know the people were promised things. And so the Senate Republicans have sat down, and it's a plan I put together when I was both chairman and ranking on the insurance committee to make not only healthcare more affordable, accessible, and improve quality, but also to keep that private market, the private insurance market, in place. And so we did a couple of things. We offered the reinsurance program, which will reduce healthcare insurance by 30%, and that was vetted by the healthcare exchange in Connecticut twice, as a matter of fact. So that's a proven, achievable 30% reduction. That's a $7,000 a year reduction in healthcare premiums for the average family of four in Connecticut. Real money, Melissa, that's $600 a month.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to look at the cost drivers. And again, we tore a page out of Republican Governor Charlie Baker's playbook in Massachusetts, and that's called benchmarking. It's a way to work collaboratively with the medical providers to get best practices and to use those to lower the cost growth in healthcare year over year. And in Massachusetts, like Connecticut, cost growth went anywhere from 10 to 12% per annum, and they were able to reduce it down to less than 4 in about 6 or 7 years, saving Massachusetts billions of dollars. We're doing the same thing now in Connecticut. We need to expand that to not just medical providers, but to look at the real cost drivers, which are pharmaceutical, and then also certain activities in hospitals. And then to get at that whole, you know, with pharmaceutical being the number one driver in healthcare costs, to look at, you know, that whole arrangement. I mean, you see things like that are developing, you know, you take electric vehicles where they get sold from the manufacturer directly to the customer. Cut out all the middlemen. Mm-hmm. Well, in pharmaceutical prescriptions, you've got all kinds of middlemen that just jack up the cost. And we need to address that and get at that so that people get lower healthcare costs.
Okay, so Senator Kelly, you outlined a lot of stuff there. So I just want to pull back sure. a little bit on some of those things. First of all, I was looking at an article that you were quoted in. It was in CT News Junkie recently. And it says here, quote, healthcare affordability needs to be tackled with a multi-pronged approach, which is what you were just describing, including mm-hmm. controlling the growth of expenses. And so the only question I have with this is, we know why health insurance is costing so much. I mean, to put it simply, we know it comes down to rising prescription drug costs, lifestyle, administrative costs, things, a lot of things that are out of our control, at least here in Connecticut, like administrative costs, for example. Part of that is because of the new rules that were put into place for the Affordable Care Act. So that's the U.S. healthcare system. So how do we change things like, you know, out-of-pocket costs or it seems like things that come from more of the federal level? Like, how much control could Connecticut really have in making insurance more affordable when it's at a higher level than what Connecticut has control over? Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does. I mean, certainly you need collaboration all over the place here. You know, we need, first of all, a bipartisan approach because there's not enough Republicans in the legislature. So we're going to need Democrat support, but we're also going to need federal support. But you take, for instance, you know, what I said at the outset, Connecticut is the fourth lowest Medicaid reimbursement rate in the nation. That's not set by Congress. That's set by the General Assembly.
How does that happen? I mean, and again, I'm not asking for like an opinion per se, but why is that the case? Why are we ranked so low in that category?
Because we don't spend the money on health care costs for people on Medicaid. So
whose fault is that, though? Like, does that come down to the hospital system? Does that come down to our lawmakers? No. Like,
yes, it was down to the lawmakers. It's our fault, not my fault. I've been arguing for an increase in the Medicaid reimbursement rate for years. But this is the problem, is when you have the low Medicaid reimbursement rate, instead of spending, let's say, 80 or 90 cents for a dollar of care for individuals on Medicaid, mm-hmm. and you're only paying 60 or 65 cents, that means the medical provider is losing money. Instead of 10 or 20 cents per dollar of care they provide, they're losing 40 cents. And what that does is that puts upward pressure on people with private insurance who are now going to be charged for the same dollar of care about $1.35.
Well, and it's also a bigger risk to them. Right. It's also a bigger risk, sure. I think, to the carriers, because they are, you know, especially with, again, when I mentioned lifestyle choices, people keeping themselves healthy and making good decisions. Unfortunately, that's a huge risk to the insurance companies.
Right. And so that's something that is absolutely controlled by the state of Connecticut, the General Assembly, and could be addressed by us at the state level. That would have a sizable impact on what healthcare delivery looks like, and that upward pressure would help reduce that upward pressure on the insurance providers, because you have that 85% rule under the Affordable Care Act.
State Senator Kevin Kelly is here. We're talking about healthcare spending in Connecticut. And Senator Kelly, we had to take a quick break, but I didn't want to cut you off as we were talking about why costs are so high and how much control Connecticut has over this debate. And you were continuing on, but I had to go to traffic and weather. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. You know, this is a complex area. And so it's not a just direct, you know, A and plus B. B equals C. There's a lot of other factors. But this is why it's important to delve into it. And if you're going to get this, you got to stick with it. And I'm happy to say, because I've been on the show before in prior years complaining that I couldn't get that reinsurance bill out of insurance committee to the Senate floor. Well, this session we finally did. We got some cooperation. And so it's now out of insurance. So that's a start, but we have still a lot of work to do. But it's really looking at, and I was happy to join the governor a couple years ago when we started benchmarking with an executive order to jumpstart this aspect and to start to look at and get medical providers with carrots, not sticks, to collaborate and to work on developing best practices on how to deliver care in the most effective way and the most efficient way. And just look at, you know, how do you fix a broken arm at St. Vincent's versus Bridgeport Hospital? How do you handle whatever the procedures are? Look at the best practices and come up with that so that you can deliver care more, you know, less expensive. But we also, one thing we did differently than Massachusetts was to make sure that the disability community and people with chronic care conditions are not left behind, that those tend to be more expensive. So we just don't want to rush to getting the cheapest, I'm going to say, healthcare, but also at the same time, don't leave anyone behind.
Senator Kelly, I have a final question for you. What do you think about Comptroller Sean Scanlon looking to expand the offerings that state workers get with the drug discount card to anyone in the state of Connecticut?
Well, you know, I had the pleasure of working with Comptroller Scanlon when he was chair and I was chair in the Insurance Committee when we were tied. Republicans were tied in the Senate. So I know that he's focused, like I am, on making sure that health care is not only delivered with quality and access, but also at the least expensive mechanism. So I think it's worthy of a conversation. We need to see what that is. Of course, once again, they've done the partnership plan, which is, say, the mini public option for Connecticut through the comptroller's office. Then it was Kevin Lembo. And each year they did that. It was done where not only because it's not insurance, it doesn't have the protections of the Affordable Care Act, i.e. pre-existing condition, it can discriminate. But also what it does is it leaves the taxpayer as the backstop. So we have to make sure that whenever you look at something that's going to operate on the state employee platform, that's a self-funded plan. It's not insurance, doesn't have the ACA protections, and at the end of the day, it's the taxpayer. If there is an overage, they're the ones that are responsible to pick up the tab, and we've got to make sure that the taxpayer in Connecticut is protected, because the other thing we hear, in addition to healthcare, is the unaffordability of Connecticut. That's why we're pushing for tax relief. I look forward to the conversation. Actually, I was with the comptroller yesterday because we had the Irish council from New York at the Capitol to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought lasting peace, or at least 30 years of peace, to Northern Ireland. And, you know, Melissa, the beauty of that is not only the celebration of peace, but it's also the celebration of American diplomacy, where America got involved because of the way we look at our, at least back 30 years ago, our political conversations, that our differences are our strength. And they got these two bitterly divided sides together and have for 30 years brought peace to Ireland. And so it shows just how exceptional American democracy can be and our role in the world to bring lasting peace.
Mm-hmm. As long as people are open-minded and willing to compromise and hear each other out, that's a nice sentiment. Yeah.
And I think that is exactly the point, is that it's through conversation. And it's not just talking at people, it's talking with people. The important aspect is to listen. And I think that's what the difference is. It's the conversation. And by having that conversation doesn't mean either party are surrendering. It just means you're working on common solutions to the problems people face.
I mean, it's one of the brokenness, I think, about politics, is that sometimes we let the R or the D define what's being said instead of just putting it aside and saying, hey, this was our idea, this is your idea, you know, do we agree or like any aspects of it, instead of just being like, oh, it came from a Republican, shut it down. Oh, it came from a Democrat, it's garbage. I think a lot of times it's a matter of just going, hey, does this make plausible sense? Is this in the best interest of the people we are serving? And that sometimes goes by the wayside, which is unfortunate. But I do think Connecticut, at least in local politics, I think we try to do the best we can to find agreements and compromise when possible. And I'm grateful for that. I'm seeing that a lot more in this session than I have in recent years. So it's a start. It's something.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kelly, I always appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. I hope you and your family enjoy your Easter weekend, and I look forward to chatting with you really soon.
And I hope you and your listeners also enjoy Easter. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Senator Kevin Kelly here on WICC.